researcher at the White House Task Force on Mental Health and Substance Use Parity. We are pleased and honored that they chose our annual meeting as a location for what we'll call a listening session, discussion session. And I think that, most of you know, the APA has been very active in the parity space, and we think that this White House Task Force is a really good thing, and we look forward to the input and the discussion. What I want to do briefly and get the program rolling is introduce Renee Bender, the president of the American Psychiatric Association, to offer a few opening remarks, and then I will hand it over to Richard Frank and Phyllis Borsey for introductions and some opening comments by them before we go to public comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. Good afternoon, everyone. So I'd like to thank the White House for organizing this task force and for their willingness to hear from psychiatrists about their struggles with parity for mental health care. And I'd also like to thank the psychiatrists who step up to deal with these issues on behalf of our patients. I'm especially appreciative to Mrs. Carter, who will be speaking later today, and to Representative Kennedy, who, of course, both of you are passionate about parity, and I'm really appreciative that you came to talk at this meeting and to participate in this. The Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act is a great law, and the agencies involved in enforcing it have made great strides toward eliminating discriminatory financial requirements and quantitative limits on treatment. The challenge facing the task force and our profession is ensuring that the parity law is carried out and enforced so that the requirement that mental health and physical health be treated equally becomes an everyday reality. And I think, as many of us in the room know, that there are still significant problems with enforcement. Our discussion today will focus on non-quantitative treatment limitations, such as prior authorizations, utilization review standards, medical necessity determinations, and network adequacy. And these aren't always obvious, but they're certainly great barriers to access mental health and substance use disorder care. Patients who are dealing with a mental illness or substance use disorder are not likely to see these barriers directly, but they certainly feel the effects of them. Because of ongoing stigma, these patients may not feel empowered to advocate for themselves, which is why it's the responsibility of their providers to stand up for them and demand access to treatment. I hope that we can continue to work together to dutifully enforce the rights of our patients and to achieve greater access to care for the vulnerable populations that we treat. Thank you.
I'm the Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration. Mine is the agency within the Department of Labor that's responsible for administering the Affordable Care Act and the parity laws, as well as many of the other health care laws. As you can tell from the fact that we're here today, this is a very high priority, implementing this law, making sure that we do it in a way that protects patients, and we know that there are a number of issues that people have on their mind here today. You should feel free to raise, I know the focus has been described a little more narrowly than what our listening sessions normally cover, but you should feel free to raise any question that you have with us. The president established this task force. It's an intergovernmental task force. It's only the government agencies. And our mission, a big part of our mission, was to go around the country, including
are gathered, and to listen. These are listening sessions. And they're called listening sessions because what we want you to do is we want you to describe for us issues, problems, concerns that you and your patients have. But most importantly, what we need for you to do is provide us some assistance in figuring out how to solve these problems. We know that there are gaps in the law. Not every problem that has been identified even so far in the brief existence of this task force are things that we can accomplish. So maybe part of the report that we'll deliver to the president in a few months will be to recommend additional legislative change. Maybe part of the report will be that we, the government agencies charged with enforcing the parity laws, maybe what we need to do is do more guidance, either regulatory guidance or what we call sub-regulatory guidance, FAQs, other kinds of guidance. But these sessions are extremely important to us. We're here to listen. And I just want to give you one little request, and that is these sessions are being recorded because we can't always write as fast. I'm not real good at multitasking. Probably some of you in the audience can identify why that is. But so it's the session is being recorded mostly as a tool to help us make sure that we correctly capture the comments that you've made and the recommendations that you made. So we want you to speak into the microphone. There'll be microphones when we get to the public. Well, I guess you can come up here and the public comment. So please don't speak out from the audience, because otherwise the recording will capture your comments. And you can speak out, it's just that no one will hear you. Therefore, I don't think it's going to be very effective. So once again, we're honored to be here with you in conjunction with this meeting, and we're particularly honored to have two of the most passionate advocates here, Mrs. Carter and former Congressman Kennedy. With that, I'm just going to stop. Richard has some comments. Richard Frank has some comments that he will make, and then we'll turn it over to you, because that's what we're here for.
Thank you. I am Richard Frank, and I'm the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation at the Department of Health and Human Services. And parity, like health reform, has been a long time in coming. If you recall, President Kennedy led the first parity initiative in 1963 when he directed the Civil Service Commission to implement parity at that time. It started, but it didn't stick. President Clinton revisited that in 1999 when he directed the Federal Employees Health Benefit Program to adopt parity, which became the jumping-off point, the basis for the Domenici-Wellstone law that we're here talking about today. Now, since this administration came into office, we've implemented the interim and the final rules on parity in 2010 and 2011, and that affected about 103. The Affordable Care Act extended parity protections to small group and individual plans, and that affected an estimated 48 million people at this point in time. Through the small group market. In combination, the Domenici-Wellstone legislation, along with the Affordable Care Act parity provisions for Medicaid and CHIP, has affected about 23 million people, and those rules became final just a few weeks ago. In addition to that, the health insurance marketplaces, the exchanges, are also subject to parity, which right now is about 12.7 million people and counting. And so we're not done yet on that one. So when you sum it up, it's 170 million people that have been touched by this legislation. Now, in addition, TRICARE, which is not subject to parity, has adopted parity provisions and has sort of equalized medical, surgical, and behavioral health. All this has led to improved care, but as Phyllis implied, and as the President noted, there's much more to do. Now, the President's memorandum calls for us to address the unfinished business of parity. We know from our research that plans have been slower to implement some provisions involving the newer and more complicated requirements in the regulations, such as those that regulate how we manage care, or what was referred to earlier as the non-quantitative treatment limits. We've also heard concerns by consumers and providers to date that some protections remain unclear. Second, that some plans are not complying with disclosure requirements on things like medical necessity criteria. And also that finding the right place to seek redress for consumers is complex, cumbersome, and confusing. So, as Phil said, we're here today to listen to your assessments of remaining problems and to hear your ideas for actions that we can take to improve matters. Now, to get us started, as Phil's mentioned, we have two tireless advocates with us. And they are Rosalind Carter and Patrick Kennedy. Now, as someone who's worked in the mental health field for a long time, one can't help but be in great admiration of Rosalind Carter. And one can also not work in this field for a long time and not really want to make her happy. And so we're here today at the President's direction, making Mrs. Carter happy. So I'd like to ask her to come to the podium and make a few remarks, and then I'll come back and introduce Patrick Kennedy.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for inviting me to be here, too. There's nothing I'm more interested in parity and seeing that it works the way it's supposed to be. And I'm looking forward to being here. I'm going to be able to stay a while. And so I'm looking forward to hearing the comments this afternoon. Well, welcome to Atlanta and the state of Georgia, which Jim and I have called home for all our lives. The Carter Center is based here in Atlanta, and my mental health program is an important activity of the Carter Center. It continues to build on my work, on the work I have undertaken for over 45 years. I started when Jimmy was governor, 1971, working on mental health issues. It's been a journey. Well, many of you have been a part of many of you, most of all of you, probably many of you have been to the Carter Center and know about some of our programs. And some of you may even remember the work we did when we were in the Carter Center. In 1977, Jim established the President's Commission on Mental Health. And it ended with the Mental Health Systems Act of 1980. And when I look back on it, it's amazing to me what we did. We had great people, Steve. Sharpstein here was one of my principal workers on the Mental Health Commission. And we included in that legislation parity, integration of mental health and substance use, incentives for people to go into the mental health field. It was really, really a great commission. And it was so important to me. And when it was put on a shelf by the incoming president, it was one of the biggest disappointments of my life. Just think of what we could have been doing right now. But anyway, our journey only started at that point, as the act never was enacted after we left the White House. It did, though, signal the start of us on the fight for parity. And finally, we have parity. It's a reality. But we all know that the struggle is not over. We need to ensure that insurance companies are held to the intent of the law. And that's not going to be easy, because the time between the passage of the law and the implementation rules were so long that the insurance companies made their own rules. And that's going to be really hard to overcome. And also, there's going to have to be strict enforcement of the act at the state level. And that's going to be another big hurdle. I know I've worked so hard for things in Georgia that would have been so good for my state and never got them. So it's going to be hard at the level. Well, I want to thank Patrick Kennedy again. I thanked him at the convocation the other night, but he wasn't there. But he and I worked close together, his staff and Patrick worked with my staff and me while we were in particular for parity. And they would call me when they thought I might help by coming to Washington, and I would come and testify. But and at the same time, I was calling Kathleen Sebelius. I knew Kathleen. Her father was governor when Jimmy was governor, so she was a good friend. And I would call Kathleen and say, when are you going to issue the rules for the implementation? And she would say, we have a staff person who goes to the White House every month when they work on priorities. And every month they put it on the list. And when the list comes out, it's not there. And the next month she goes back and it's not there. One time when I called her, she said, why don't you call the White House? And I did. To no avail. Well, it was a very proud moment for me. When in November of 2013, Secretary Sebelius came to our symposium and announced the rules for implementation. And it just was rolled out. You know, when you've been working on something so long and finally it's here, it was just a great day for me. Well, I applaud you today as you tackle the parity implementation work for the task force. You have my best respect and regards for being willing to take on this task. And I stand with you, and we'll be looking forward to following you with great anticipation. Thank you very much.
Patrick energetically pursues parity, his passion and his impatience are both incredibly important and incredibly admirable for us. I've worked with Patrick, I've seen it up close, I've worked in the government, and I've been on the receiving end of it, and it's always in the spirit of moving us forward. So we are really grateful that he made time to join us today to help us kick off the President's Task Force.
And Richard, you'll be on the receiving again today. Thank you, Richard, for that, and to Phyllis, thank you for both of your service to our country and the roles that you currently hold and the trust you have for the American people to follow the President's admonition that we fully implement and enforce the Federal Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. And obviously, I'm so honored. It's in politics, very rarely do you hear that someone has said nice things about you behind your back. But that was the great occurrence for me all evening, last evening, as everyone said, Mrs. Carter kept saying nice things about you. Where were you? I just want to say it's been such an honor to work with Mrs. Carter. As you can tell, she could be doing so many other things in her life, and she has chosen to stay firm with this commitment that she's had for her whole life. And it means so much to all of us that we've had her as a steady force to implement equality. So here we are, Mrs. Carter, in Atlanta, Georgia. We just have seen the opening of the great Civil Rights Museum, marking the historic movement started in this community by the late Dr. Martin Luther King. How appropriate that we are here today to really try to add the next chapter of guaranteeing equal protection and access to American liberty that has too long been denied people simply because their illness is an illness of the brain as opposed to any other organ of their body. And in the history of civil rights, Frederick Douglass said it best, power concedes nothing without demand. It never has, and it never will. And what we need from you, Secretary Bosie and Secretary Frank, is we need you to stand up for the people against the power, the incredible power of the insurance industry in this country, who are going to do everything in their power to keep things as they are. And you're going to hear a lot of great testimony today, but let me just illustrate what I think is the essence, if there's nothing else that you take from my comments. It is that there's going to be no way for us to implement parity as required under the statute unless we can actually measure as the law requires how behavioral health is compared with medical and surgical. The law is worthless if you don't have the ability to measure not only the quantitative treatments, but the non-quantitative treatments. And the law requires it. And we haven't gotten it from the implementation of the law because there is no way for us to be able to tell whether there is a violation or not, because there's no disclosure. And I mean more than just giving me a list of criteria. I need to know how those criteria are applied across medical, surgical, and mental health and addiction. Unless I know what the criteria are and how they're applied across, then the law is not being fulfilled because there's no way to guarantee that there is analogous care along every form of level of severity that there would be for the medical and surgical patient. Finally, we need to be able to audit on a regular basis insurance company practices as it relates to the disclosure. First, we need disclosure. Then we need an ability to constantly monitor that disclosure against the evidence that those who are in this room and who are practitioners of mental health and addiction services nationwide will be able to provide us in terms of their experience, because they know firsthand what the real application of the law looks like. And to Mrs. Carter's point about how she wants it applied in states around the country who are often the first line of defense for patients, those insurance company, insurance commissioners and attorneys general will not know how to do their job unless they have that disclosure and that toolkit, essentially, in order for them to do their job. We cannot expect each of the 50 states to come up with their own insurance oversight. So, Richard, I was in Rhode Island just a couple weeks ago, and we have two people trying to audit all the insurance companies in Rhode Island. They are overwhelmed. They cannot even begin to audit this properly. Why? Because there's two of them and there's thousands in the insurance industry who produce really nice, well-kept pieces of paper that say they've checked all the boxes. How in the world are two people going to be able to verify
that the people of Rhode Island are actually getting protected or not. And by the way, that's in every state that I've been to. Every one of those insurance commissioners, I was just with Gary Tennis in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, he said the same thing to me. Governor Wolf said the same thing to me. Everywhere I go, these governors and attorney general insurance commissioners said, we cannot do this because these insurance companies are going to roll right over us. We're too small to do this. It rests with the federal government to do the most important things, and that is require, as is provided for under the ACA, you have the authority to do this, disclosure, and also to require having those audits. And then you can let the states do what they're empowered to do to protect consumers. And I, again, thank you, Secretary Frank and Secretary Borsi, for making this possible for all of us today. And just to know, there is no historic coincidence that this hearing is in the place where civil rights really got its start, because we need to finalize that continued march towards progress that my late father talked about all the time and ensure that we no longer have suicide rates exceeding 41,000 a year and overdose rates exceeding car accidents as the single largest cause of death. And that, my friends, is proof positive Exhibit A. Exhibit A for the fact that we're not following parity, because nowhere would we allow so many people to reach stage four illness and have the ultimate tragedy of suicide or overdose if we were treating those people as we would cancer or heart disease or any other illness early in stage one. If there's one side proof positive that parity is not fully enforced, it's that we're seeing this kind of incident and this kind of mortality due to mental illness and addiction. So let's help correct that and make this place a historic meeting for change.
Kennedy, you are a very hard act to follow, and I'm only blaming myself because I did the agenda, so next time I'm completely changing it around. I'm Colleen Coyle, I'm APA's General Counsel, and what I'm going to do is just introduce a little bit from the thousands of complaints that we get from members and patients about their ability to access care or not, and try to put together what APA has derived from this in terms of what we think the problem is. By about 9 or 10 people who have spoken to other people to collect information and to bring to you a sort of summary of those problems. And then what we'd like to do is open it up to the floor for other people to contribute. So I think where we are in terms of parity, and I think most people in APA would agree with this, is that we're pretty good on the financial limitations, and we're pretty good on the quantitative treatment limitations, with the exception maybe of days of coverage and a few other items. But these are easy to see. You look at the plan document and you see how much the copay is. On this side, you see how much the copay is on that side. So they're very easy to see, and we've made a lot of progress on those. The door is kind of closed on the financial limitations, but we're hanging on by a thread. And the reason why we're hanging on by a thread is there's a giant back door in the non-quantitative treatment. And those non-quantitative treatment limitations are coming in, and what they do is they limit access, and more importantly is they shift the costs to the patient. And so we're right back to the front door with financial limitations. And that's not where we need to be. So this is sort of the blue boxes here are kind of the non-quantitative treatment limitations that I think we see every day, and the practitioners see every day, and the patients see every day. And what they do is individually, they limit access to care. But collectively, what they do is they drive psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers and all other mental health care providers right out of the networks. Not just because of the rates of pay, but because for every patient you see, you have to spend 45 minutes on the phone trying to get the ability to treat them. And then you can't see two more patients And so in order to increase access, people are actually leaving the networks, which is counterintuitive. This isn't the way it's supposed to be. And so what we'd like to do is call upon folks from, well, let me just say on the network adequacy issue, we also started doing some studies of network adequacy and reported yesterday. And with the ACA, our members frequently hear, we're narrowing networks. We don't have any room for you in here because we have this brilliant thing called a narrow network. Well, in D.C., 86% of the psychiatrists called are not available to take patients on the exchange plans. That is unbelievable, and it is really a severe limitation to access. And so I'd like to call on Dr. Jerry Musher to start our program.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Jeremy Musher. I'm a psychiatrist, and I work at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and Western Psychiatric Institute and Clinic. For 10 years, I served as the medical director of a psychiatric emergency room. Additionally, for over 20 years, I've worked as a psychiatric healthcare consultant to hospitals, healthcare systems, physician groups, and healthcare law firms. In that capacity, I've worked with hundreds of psychiatric hospitals and psychiatric units in medical surgical hospitals. I would like to focus my comments today on one particular recurrent experience I've had in working with those hospitals. In my experience, medical management standards are handled differently for medical surgical patients than for mental health substance use disorder patients. If you go into the hospital for a surgical procedure or for a potentially life-threatening symptom like a gastrointestinal bleed, your prior authorization process is handled with some specific targeted information conveyed to the insurer, and then only if your length of stay in the hospital exceeds the expected time frame for similar patients would a concurrent review take place to identify reasons for your extended stay. If, however, you were being hospitalized due to having a plan to kill yourself, having been found with a gun in your hand by your spouse, your insurer would want a comprehensive series of questions answered to grant initial approval for your hospitalization. The obvious danger is insufficient to support hospitalization, and granting a number of approved days consistent with the average length of stay for patients in psychiatric hospitals, 7 to 10 days for adults, doesn't occur. The reviewer questions include both current symptoms and circumstances, specifics about the suicidal behavior, and in one extreme case, even asking how many bullets were in the gun, as well as past mental health history, prior hospitalizations, current outpatient treatments, etc. There is no counterpart to these kinds of interrogations on the medical side in order to grant an initial hospitalization coverage. Subsequent concurrent stay reviews then begin often within a day or two of hospitalization, with requests for utilization review nurses to read physician, nurse, and treatment progress notes to the insurance reviewer with follow-up questions like, but does he say he's still planning to kill himself today? As if only a direct statement of imminent intent justifies continued hospitalization. In my experience, these are relatively common examples. Certainly not universal, but definitely common. Because of the increased utilization review burden for psychiatric patients, medical surgical hospitals with psychiatry beds have to disproportionately staff their utilization review departments with psychiatric utilization review nurses to cover a much smaller number of psychiatric beds than the much larger number of medical surgical beds. I've seen 2 to 3 psychiatric utilization review nurses for approximately 30 to 40 beds, and only 1 or 2 medical utilization review nurses for 60 to 80 beds. Obviously, although the UR processes may be similar between medical and psychiatric patients, they are very different in reality with respect to the actual burden providers experience to fulfill reviewer demands. This disparity in the actual content and time involved in these reviews is not compliant with what I understand the parity regulations require. This seriously affects the financial viability of these bids, considering the reality that payers pay lower rates for psychiatric care, yet the cost of securing payment for that care is higher. We've all seen psychiatric beds closed in hospitals as the cost of operating the beds places unacceptable burdens on hospitals who are unable to continue to subsidize psychiatric care. All of this is happening at a time when there is a great unmet need for these services and where access to mental health and substance use disorders services in this country continues to be a national challenge. Thank you for your efforts towards improving compliance with parity for mental health and substance use disorder services, and we look forward to the outcome of your task force. Thank you.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Jerry Halverson. I am a psychiatrist and medical director at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. At Rogers, we're a private not-for-profit psychiatric health system. I provide care on the inpatient unit as well as the partial IOP level of care and the residential level of care. And I'm here really to share some of my experiences with getting patients the care that the doctor in the room and their families are all hoping, praying, and recommending for, and the struggles that we have with that. I will also talk quite a bit about opioid dependence, as that's been a huge issue in my state, as I'm sure it's been in everybody's state. I just finished my presidential year as the Wisconsin Medical Society president, and we did a lot of legislative work, and there's still a lot of legislative work to do. Anyway, I'm here basically to talk about the impact that these barriers that I believe are imposed by the insurance companies are having on access. Patient population, as all of the clinicians in here know, is a very heterogeneous patient population. Most folks that come into my particular specialty is a young adult mood disorder program. So my young adult mood disorder program obviously has some substance issues, has some eating disorder issues, has some personality issues, all of the above, and it can get quite messy. But it really doesn't seem, the questions that I get asked, that I do a great deal of utilization review. We're very quote-unquote insurance friendly. Probably 80% of the care that we give is with insurance. So I spend probably 4 hours a week doing insurance reviews at least, probably more than that. And, you know, in the time that I've been here, I've had to do reviews. Anyway, they really do not seem consistent with this reality that we have, that every patient is a little bit different. We do seem to have pretty much the same criteria spit back to me on a daily basis. So the first piece, and Dr. Musher talked about this a little bit, there's a lot of fail-first stuff that continues to happen. I have a great deal of trouble getting folks into residential, whether they have an appropriate partial program or not. There's a demand that they have done a partial program, and I will now at this point, you know, I've been engaged in this. So, you know, you're not telling me that they have to fail that first, because that's not legal. Oh no, that we're not saying fail first. They just have to give it a try. even though there isn't a partial program within an hour for many of these people, Wisconsin's relatively rural, and we get people actually from New York City, and there's not a partial program that's appropriate, that's close. And there really is this fail first piece really does exist, and that is absolutely the case. And that is very true with opioid detox. Opioid detox is very, very difficult for some payers to have coverage for. Obviously, you have families that bring their loved ones in. This loved one's finally willing to come into the hospital. You bring them to the hospital, and the insurance company says, well, you're not actively looking to kill yourself. So this is really something that you don't need to go inpatient for. You need to go to a partial hospital or an IOP, and the partial and IOP aren't really willing to take these folks that are still actively withdrawing. And that has absolutely been a challenge. And then with residential in particular, the other thing that I wanted to mention was the criteria that we get asked. I think with parity, we've frankly had more people get in the door. There are less people getting turned away. We're a national referent, so we're getting people from all over. But then after a week, I get a patient rejected saying, well, they didn't meet residential criteria. Well, they met residential criteria a week ago. They're obviously just settling into this program. We haven't done anything that is going to help them stay well. But again, they get sent home, which is a lot of our patients are dependent on their insurance. I have these benefits. These benefits should be paying for this care that's needed, that my doctor says is needed, that the family feels is needed. So, you know, we've had a whole lot of experience with the entire continuum of care being covered, but having a real difficult time accessing it. And that is really the point that I wanted to make, is I do believe that parity has had a lot of positive aspects to it. People are talking about mental illness. We are getting more people into treatment, but we are certainly still not able to treat people to as well as need to be. We're not able to treat people to remission because we're still being caught up in these in a lot of these policies.
Hampshire, one of the states that has been most devastated by the current opioid addiction epidemic. Buprenorphine is a medication that has shown enormous success in treating opioid addiction and in saving lives. It is generally prescribed as a chronic, long-term treatment over several years. Both of the Medicaid managed care operators in New Hampshire, Healthy Families and WellSense, as well as Anthem, the single largest private insurer in the state, require prior authorization for buprenorphine on an outpatient basis every 3 months. These insurance companies do not do this for other chronically prescribed medications for medical surgical issues. For example, a diabetic does not need continuous prior authorization for insulin, and patients with high cholesterol do not need constant prior authorizations for cholesterol-lowering medications like Lipitor. This is clearly an anti-buprenorphine and anti-substance abuse bias. Getting prior authorization is not easy. It requires a physician making often a 20-minute phone call, often getting put on hold, then speaking with a high school-level educated clerk who reads off a checklist of criteria to make a decision. If the decision is no, it requires one or more further phone calls by the physician to try to get this decision reversed. The prior authorization process often results in delays in patients getting their medication filled at the pharmacy, which frequently results in a relapse of using heroin or other illicit opioids, which then puts patients at significant risk for overdose and death. The prior authorization on the physician side is taking up as much as 20 to 30% of private psychiatrists' time which could be better spent serving patients. The opioid epidemic in this country is now one of this nation's most serious public health problems. Insurance companies should not be allowed to make it more difficult for these patients to get the treatment they are prescribed, or to discourage doctors from treating these patients altogether due to the creation of needless hassles in their work. Thank you.
My name is Jake Behrens. I'm a professional psychiatrist at the University of Wisconsin. Outside of my normal day job, I also sit on the medical advisory board for one of the largest mail order pharmacies and pharmacy benefit manufacturers in the country. And after being on that board and as a psychiatrist and speaking with all the other specialties, as well as getting into deeper conversations with staff from the company, came to realize that we are the only specialty that has to fill out prior authorizations for guideline-based first-line generic medications. When I brought that up to the board, I was actually laughed at about the other specialties. This is something they never had ever thought about. They just thought if they could choose generic, they're doing everything they could and they'd be fine. And they're just upset because they don't have generic medications, whereas we actually do have many that are effective. What I found in here is when we have to fill out prior authorizations for a first-line, guideline-based generic medication, that's what we think of. We come here, we're educated, we do as much community medical education as we can. I'm a frugal person, you try and prescribe the most cost-beneficial medication as you can, but even then, we still have to go through a prior authorization process, which does not take part in other specialties in medicine. And another area is, in my outpatient practice, I specialize in ADHD in adults, which I know is a relatively controversial area, but something where I want to point out of how systems can really affect one, like prescribing habits as well as the behaviors of physicians as well as patients, is as of the first of the year, numerous of our formulary plans, including the largest state plan that covers all state workers and the university throughout all of Wisconsin, recently changed their formulary to change the tiering of different medications. With stimulants, which are controlled substances in the same category as opiates, all previously having been tier one for generic medications. But as of the first of the year, I'm now getting calls from patients wondering why their extended release, guideline-based, less divertible, less abusable, and better compliance extended release versions of stimulants now went from $15 to $50 to $75. Patients saying they can't afford that, basically forcing me over the phone to convert everyone to immediate release stimulants, I'm on a college campus, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin, and it's the behaviors of this, with me trying to best serve my patients. I want to give them something that I want to be able to help treat them as best as I can, but also in the most cost-effective way. But this is leading to higher rates of more abusable, more divertible, less compliant medications against the guidelines that I know myself, but I'm trying to do this in the best care of my patients, and it puts us as physicians in a very precarious spot to who are we trying to serve the best. Thank you.
My name is Jennifer Erskine, and I represent a billing company. So I am not a doctor, but I am the one processing, helping you get your money and get paid. So my billing service is in Central Florida. We represent more than 70 different providers and 19 different specialties. So I see what you're going through, and I see what you're going through compared to everybody else out there. Let me give you an example of one of the obstacles that we're facing. I have a doctor who's here today. Dr. P is a psychiatrist, and he had a thriving practice when I started working for this company more than 7 years ago. Decreased reimbursements, higher overhead costs, access to networks has caused him to not be the successful practice that he once was, and he has chosen to now go to hospital-based. So he only does consulting out of one of our local hospitals. So what he does, he gets a consult, he goes, he sees the patient, and then he hands it in and says, I'm done, I've seen the patient, it's your problem now. And this is where my adventure begins. There are a lot of companies out there that have outsourced their third-party carriers. In our state, in Florida, Medicaid is a big payer, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Humana, these have all been outsourced to third-party carriers. So what happens is, patient comes in for a medical condition, they're admitted to the hospital, they are seen for a medical reason, and they get a consult because the patient's confused. So they call in a psychiatrist. The hospital is going to bill Freedom Health because that's who their insurance is. But Freedom Health outsourced all their claims to PsychCare. So the hospital authorization does not apply to this psychiatrist. We have to go get our own authorization. So every time that we see any Freedom patients, actually PsychCare covers 11 different carriers in our area. They cover Coventry, a Medicaid HMO Prestige. Almost all of the different insurance companies in our area have to be authorized as a prior authorization, but of course they're not really a prior authorization because he's already seen these patients because he was called in and he's going to see them regardless. So we send the claim to PsychCare, who is the third-party carrier for Prestige or Freedom, and we first have to get our auth. We get our auth, we send it in fax, because they don't like to be called. They want you to send it in writing. You fax it, and you fax it again and again and again. And maybe 6 weeks later you have it, maybe you don't, but you're running out of timely filing, so you send it anyway, you send your claim, because now you don't want to run out of your timely filing limits at 90 days. So now what? You wait. You have to wait 60 days before you can call the insurance company to get claim status. And if you had an authorization, good for you. It doesn't mean your authorization is actually going to get paid. Your authorization, they send you a number. It doesn't say how many visits. It doesn't say what level of service. So you have to even further call or go to their website to find out for sure that the things that you've already seen the patient for are the things that are getting authorized. We send our claim, and this patient, again, was seen for a medical condition. And so the medical condition is the primary diagnosis code. I am a certified ICD-10 coder. I can tell you it was coded correctly. And the principal diagnosis is the medical condition with the manifestation of the confusion. And they send the claim back denied because the mental health diagnosis was not the primary diagnosis. It was coded correctly, but there's no fixing it. So they tell you it has to be first. Even though coding guidelines tell you that's wrong, we send it in, and then they tell us you coded it wrong. Okay, so now what? So now you can appeal, but you send in your appeal and it's an unprocessable claim because you didn't have your codes correct. And basically what that amounts to is he never gets paid because we jump through every hurdle that there is and we're still not getting anywhere. You try to resolve those issues with PsychCare directly. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to respond to your emails. They don't want to call back. You take it to the company that PsychCare has been outsourced from, Humana or Freedom. They don't want to hear it because you're a mental health provider and they send all their mental health over here. So you have really no source to go back and get the information that you need. And you don't have a voice for the insurance company to help you get your claims paid because they're both pointing the fingers at each other. So, on a personal note, I just wanted to say I have a six-year-old who's, we call her Spirited. She was kicked out of the after-school program at her school in kindergarten in February. And so at that point, my husband and I finally decided that the minor behavioral issues that she was experiencing were perhaps more than we were equipped to handle. And I called. We have a Blue Cross Blue Shield HMO. I went on the website. I did all the right things. I called my pediatrician. He recommended two psychiatrists. I called them. They don't take insurance. Zero. No insurance. It's $220 to $330 an hour each, which is kind of the standard rate. I can't afford that right now, so let's go to our insurance and see who else is out there. There's two facilities on my insurance plan. Lots of providers, but only two facilities. One facility is inpatient, which really she's just doing shenanigans. It's not there yet. The other facility I called on April 5th, I still don't have an appointment. I've called every week because she needs to be seen and it's more than I can do. But I was told that unless she is in imminent danger to herself or others, there's nothing they can do until a spot becomes available. Because right now, all they have is a certain number of therapists and a certain number of clients, and every spot is full. So I'll let you know when we get an appointment.
Good afternoon. This is Carter. I apologize in advance, but I'm not going to make you happy with what I'm about to say. Unfortunately, you're going to be very unhappy, but I think that we're all here to try to change that. My name is Dr. Steve Davis. I am a Maryland psychiatrist. I've worked in integrated care settings, hospitals, emergency rooms, primary care offices for over 20 years. I'm a clinical assistant professor at the University of Maryland. I led the Department of Psychiatry at Baltimore Washington Medical Center, just outside of Baltimore, for 9 years, and I'm currently the Chief Medical Informatics Officer at M3 Information. I also have personal experience with severe mental illness in a number of my family members. I've been involved with legislative efforts to improve access to quality care for people with behavioral health conditions for my entire career, identifying egregious cases of insurance discrimination against people with mental health and substance use disorders has unfortunately become a very common aspect of my advocacy efforts, both with advocacy folks like you and legislative efforts, but just trying to get people the help and the care that they need. Psychiatrists typically have only a basic understanding of the Mental Health Parity Act, but they never see what happens on the physical health side. They know, just like we just heard, they know what happens to their billing stuff, but they don't really know what's happening on the medical side. So it's hard to know when you're being discriminated against. I will share a very, I'm actually here speaking for myself, but there are two other psychiatrist who could not attend, so I'm actually speaking for three people, so I won't go too long. I want to share a very recent story about an APA member in Maryland, Dr. Linda Frey. Linda, her story illustrates problems with contract terms, retroactive reviews, vague and spurious so-called standards for medical necessity review, refusal to disclose information by the payers necessary to appeal claims for patients, which is required by the law, thank you. The incredible hassle that causes psychiatrists to leave networks. In fact, psychiatrists have been systematically discouraged from participating in insurance networks by what feels to me like bureaucratic bullying. Dr. Frey's story is not unique. We repeatedly hear from psychiatrists this summer all of these problems. She contracted with United Behavioral Health, a mental health carve-out company, as an in-network psychiatrist, and has been, this is also called UBH, this has been a UBH, she's been a UBH provider for 19 years. She told me that she only uses in-network practitioners for her own personal health care and believes it's the right thing to do to stay in insurance and accept it because she knows about how hard it is for people to access care. In her contract, UBH reserved the right to lease their network if they deemed it appropriate to essentially rent her out to another company. And UBH in the past 5 or so years leased its network, including Dr. Frey's services, to GEHA, or Government Employees Health Association, an insurance company. Dr. Frey has no contract with GEHA, only with UBH, but due to UBH selling her availability to GEHA, she became responsible for treating their patients as well. Now, this impacts the adequacy of the network in several ways. Dr. Frey now appears in two different network directories, right? So her availability to each network has now been cut in half, although in their network, it looks like that they've got even more providers who can provide care. She provides services to GEHA patients and is subject to review by them, but is contracted only with UBH, not GEHA. So UBH states that they can't help her if there's a problem with GEHA. But because she has no contract with GEHA, she has no ability to arbitrate or bring litigation against them. It's sort of a heads I win, tails you lose scenario. So when a problem arises that can't be cured with GEHA, as it has for her, her only legal option is to resign from UBH's network so that she can get out of GEHA. And she's very frustrated by this. She's still extremely frustrated, trust me. This would result in a disruption in care and higher costs for her patients in both UBH and GEHA, while both companies save money by no longer having to pay for their patients' treatment. We know this is short-sighted savings because it's well documented that people with chronic medical conditions who also have problems with co-occurring mental health or substance abuse conditions wind up with more complications and cost the healthcare system 2 and 3 times more than if their mental health problems were under control. So while Dr. Frey's main patient base is with UBH, she began seeing GEHA patients for both medical evaluation and management and for psychotherapy when indicated. This is where the nightmare begins. I'm almost there. In May of 2015,
GEHA began denying claims for patients that she was seeing for medical evaluation and management. Now, a lot of you probably knows what this is. E&M code is also, it's medical evaluation. In fact, I see that these are the codes we're talking about, these CBT codes right here, which I noticed, I don't know where this comes from, Virginia, I guess, but I noticed that a psychiatrist insurance pays for the longest code, which is about a 40-minute or so session, $80, whereas other physicians, it's $250. And we just heard that in your area, an average psychiatrist is about $200, $250 an hour, which is exactly this price, but they're not paying it. So GEHA has refused to reimburse her for those types of services, just psychotherapy. Even though she's using that time with her patient to determine are her treatments working, are there side effects, whether her patients are getting better or not. Initially, GEHA claimed that the documentation was inadequate, but then she produced the documentation. Now, I don't know how they can say that it was inadequate when they didn't have it. So she produced the documentation, and then they said, it's clear that, here's a quote, "It is clear that you have appropriately documented the service and that the service was provided. However, we have now determined that these patients didn't meet the E&M standards that we have, even though all patients were reviewed on medications and had comorbid medical problems. It clearly required that level of management." GEHA did agree to pay for the psychotherapy, but not these medical management services. She saw her patients at intervals that were appropriate based on medical judgment and the patient's history. Nonetheless, GEHA unilaterally established these so-called standards of care that were inconsistent and appeared to be self-serving. Example, so they deemed that one patient needed medical review only every 6 weeks rather than every 4 weeks that she was doing. But another patient, they said, we're only going to pay this every 12 weeks. And for another one every 9 weeks. They seem like random intervals, and when asked for, well, show me the standards of care that you have, that you rely on to come up with these things, we couldn't get it. This is really the corporate practice of medicine, it seems, and it's, the way this is done is unsafe, it's without an evidence base, and it's dangerous. Dr. Fry asked repeatedly for the medical basis for these things, and they just said, it's the standard of care in the industry, and that's the answer. So for clarity here, there is no such standard of care in the industry, no guidelines around this, no respectable psychiatrist who would claim that those standards exist. The APA then got involved with her patient's permission, and they asked for, so APA said, okay, give us the evidentiary basis of these alleged standards of care, the clinical guidelines, as well as documentation on how the reviewer applied the guidelines to these facts. And the APA has requested the same information on the medical side, too. We want to compare them. How do you know if they're different unless you have both sides? And GEHA responded that only that its standard was based on, quote, generally accepted standards of good medical practice in the United States. That's what they got. We still have yet to receive any of these standards from them. So while GEHA is the only insurance company I'm aware of that restricts medical evaluation and management on this basis that I've previously, I just in the past few days, in talking to others, I've heard of at least one other payer that's placing restrictions on this type of psychiatric office visit evaluation, while another is using a for-profit company to pressure a different psychiatrist to provide a lower frequency of care to people with serious psychiatric illness. In January 2016, the APA wrote to the Office of Personnel Management and highlighting this problem that the use of these arbitrary standards for all psychiatric patients to determine whether their treatment is medically necessary. Okay, I'm getting the flag here. So a request to UBH to assist with this grievance was denied, claiming that it was not their, UBH's, it was not their medical necessity standard, but that of GEHA's. So around and around we go. how has this affected her, Dr. Fry, and her patients? She stopped taking patients from the plan. She is treating the ones she had without pay. Most psychiatrists, many psychiatrists would not do this. I know many who would. She has been through three levels of internal appeals for each of her patients, hundreds of pages of documentation. She spent over 150 hours of uncompensated time trying to get access to appropriate care for her patients. And this is time that she, of course, could have been seeing other patients. We heard earlier somebody said that psychiatrists are leaving insurance so they can increase access to care. It is counterintuitive, but what choice do we have? So it seems like some payers are intent on using contract and paperwork methods to make it hard for psychiatrists to remain in network and for patients with mental health conditions to remain in treatment. America needs your help, everyone's help, to force payers to treat mental health and addiction the same way they treat diabetes and heart disease. Thank you.